and welcome to the PC Gamer Show. I won't forget to introduce ourselves this time around. My name is James. James Davenport.
Oh.
I did it. I'm here with...
Wesley Fanelson? Is that...
Yeah, what?
That's me. That's me.
The known Wesley Fanelson, features editor at PCGamer.com. How you doing?
That's an in-joke for for James and I that you guys may not be aware of. There's a long-time like games industry imposter who likes to email PR people with... Yeah. Fake names and try to get them to send them keys and stuff.
Yes.
And for a couple months, he was going by my name, except Fanelson, the knockoff version of me, trying to get game codes.
Yeah,
from publishers.
So that's Wes's name now.
That's me. Yeah.
Even our editor in chief, global editor in chief, Tim, just doesn't lay off on it. But
that's me forever. Thanks to
it's just imagine Wes,
some student in China.
Wes with like
his IP.
Like a bowler hat, like tipped over your. You know, casting a shadow over your eyes, and I don't know.
Is this like a m'lady situation?
I don't know. I'm just trying to imagine Wesley Fanelson in the shadows asking for codes.
Give me your games.
You got any game codes for me? It's me, Wesley Fanelson. Let's talk about games, though. Today, it's been like a... It's been a super busy week in terms of game news.
I think it's a pretty light week, yeah.
Yeah, pretty light week so far. So we're kind of just going to talk about what we've been playing for... quite a while, and we've been playing. The good thing is we've all been playing video games in a few different ones.
All two of us, yes. Yeah. We've been playing video games, yeah.
And then we'll have an extended Twitch chat Q&A. So
ready your questions.
Yeah, get your questions ready.
Think about them.
Don't send them yet, because then I'll have to scroll up. Twitch chat doesn't have a way to pin those, and I'm going to miss them.
Questions or even just like topics, maybe?
Yeah.
Something you want to talk about?
Anything you want to talk about. Like maybe we did miss something in the news, and you want to bring that up, and we can address that. But yeah, let's talk about what we've been playing. And Wes, there's one thing you introduced me to this week. I want you to kind of...
subjected you to against your will.
Forced upon me.
Forced upon you.
What is this game?
So I've gotten back into NetHack this weekend.
NetHack.
Which I think I wrote about in my like high and low or something last week.
Yep.
I had a cold last week, and I was kind of at this in this place where I was just like watching a bunch of TV and didn't really feel like I had the... mental energy to handle an FPS or an action game. And I was like, okay, this is finally a good time. I've kind of had a hankering for it to get back into NetHack, which is a now 30-year-old roguelike.
30?
Based on Rogue.
Oh my God.
The original like.
It's older than me.
But yeah, so NetHack is the evolution of Rogue. It first came out in 87, I think, and then has since been updated many, many times over the years, had a lot of iterations and updates, including one about a year and a half ago. So it is weirdly still in development. I think that was the first one in like 11 years or something crazy like that. But it is as traditional a roguelike as it gets. You start in a dungeon, you're going through floors and floors of these kind of maze-like ASCII hallways, getting killed very quickly by monsters if you don't know what you're doing. And there's an incredible amount of stuff to learn about this game. And I probably know like 5% of it.
And and the knowledge you have to me seems immeasurable compared to like my brief time with the game.
So I got James to play it a little bit just like at lunch on Monday earlier this week. And we play it on this server called nethack.alt.org, which if you become interested in playing NetHack, I highly recommend you playing on this server, because you can just download a free client for Windows or Mac, whatever, to telnet into it. That's how old this game is. You're going to telnet into this server, and you're basically just playing, you do that like as a command line thing in PuTTY on Windows, for example. And then you log into the server, you can create an account, it's totally free. It will save your progress probably like every single move. I've never had it lose any progress, even if I just like quit the application without manually saving. And you can play online, so you can pick up your progress from any computer you're on. And the really cool thing about playing on the server is it tracks all the history of your games, and you can actually go and watch replays of your own games as well as other people's games.
Yeah.
So you can see every action you took, rewatch your glorious successes, or more likely your failures, because this game's really hard.
Yeah.
And you will always have the possibility when it generates a dungeon level for you the first time you like enter a floor for it to be a bones level, which I was telling James about. Yeah. And I think this was probably what sold you on checking the game
absolutely
out.
Absolutely is. I'm too easy.
It's kind of a mechanic that Dark Souls, I feel like maybe they didn't deliberately reference this, but it's definitely in that lineage.
Yeah.
So a bones level will basically pull in the level data from someone else's previously failed run on NetHack, and you will get a level that was the same layout as the level that they died on, and will include the same monster that killed them, the other monsters that were on that level, as well as their grave, their corpse, laying somewhere on the level. And so sometimes you can get some really amazing loot from the corpse of a previous adventurer. Also, sometimes you could get some really shitty loot. Like sometimes you'll go pick up somebody's gear and think, oh, this was going to be great. And then they just had tons of cursed items that screw you over. Or you might get killed by the same monster that killed them.
Exactly.
Or maybe you'll prove yourself tougher. So that's a really cool mechanic for, especially for a game that's, you know, 30 years old. I don't know how long that's been in the game, but at least for quite a while, I think. So I'm making my way through NetHack dungeons, trying to. I've had a lot of failed runs over the weekend.
Are you still resolved to beat this game? Because there is, you can beat this game.
You can beat it. It has a definitive ending. Your goal in NetHack is to go get the, I think it's called the Amulet of Yendor, though I might my Tolkien-esque.
It's some amulet wrong. MacGuffin. Yeah.
You're trying to get an amulet, and then you're trying to get back out.
You have to retrace your steps?
You're going all the way down and then coming all the way back up. And I think there's a lot to the game in the late game and the middle game that's very different than the beginning, which is very much just like going through a dungeon, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've kind of deliberately avoided looking up any of that stuff because I want to earn it, basically. Yeah. I want it to be a surprise. But I have been using like the NetHack Wiki to learn properties of monsters when I go to eat them. You need to eat like the corpses of your enemies, because if you don't, you'll probably starve. But some things you don't want to eat, they're bad for you. So I'll look those up. I'll look up like some armor stats when I come across it. But yeah, it's a hard game. I want to beat it. But my friend Jeremy, who's been sort of my guru for NetHack, he's like, don't worry about beating it quickly. Like think of that as like a years long goal that you may someday reach.
You did a series, if I remember correctly, on our site, actually kind of detailing your venture into.
Yeah. So Jeremy, my friend, did this video series with me. We did like 15 episodes or so last year. Just kind of learning like the very basics.
Did you make a playlist of this?
There should be a playlist on our YouTube channel. Yeah, it's called NetHack from A to Zrudy.
I will share it.
A is that it's actually A to Zrudy, and the A's symbolize ants, which are just like one of the generic enemies that will come after you. But they're a very common like first death, newbie death in NetHack, because sometimes you'll open a door and there's like a hive of ants in there, and they'll fuck you up. And then Zrudy is a creature. So real clever name there. But we probably imparted upon me, you know, 15% of the total possible knowledge of important stuff for NetHack. And I absorbed some small percentage of that I still remembered.
I think it's important to like, for people who are like, I'll never play this, I'll never try it because it's so unknowable and big. It's there's appeal in it for just all of the insane shit that can happen. Even if you never resolve to finish the game, I've had so much fun just like in my first couple ventures, just poking around and seeing all the colossal ways I can fail.
There's an incredible amount of interactivity between objects and things in that game, most of which I still don't know about. Like when I introduced you to it very vaguely, we didn't even talk about the systems involving water and writing. And there's so much to it. Like you'll get scrolls in the game that have magical effects. You can also wash scrolls and remove the writing on them and turn them into a blank scroll. If you have the right item, you can then write on a scroll and create your own scroll, turn it into a different spell. There are ways to bless items. There are ways to, you can dip your bow and arrows into a potion that's poisonous and shoot that at enemies. So there are a lot of things you can do in the game, even though it's based on text, or maybe because of it's based on text, that are just sort of logical interactions. Like, what would happen if you dip a potion into water? Like, you're going to dilute it.
Yeah.
And that's not the kind of mechanic that you would necessarily expect to be rendered in a game, because it's sort of just like a realism thing. Mm-hmm. And that if this was a game like The Witcher, they have to kind of design an entire graphical system around this and factor it in the game. And in this, it's just like, no, it just tells you, you know, your potion has been diluted. And there's a ton of things like that in the game that, thanks to its simple graphics, it can just go super, super deep. But it does have an ending. It's not like Dwarf Fortress, where it's just simulating this insanely complex system of existence, basically. It is still a game. Dwarf Fortress is not really a game, at least not the fortress mode.
No, it's like an ant colony that you can influence.
So that's my obscure hardcore PC game of the week.
I think it's one to, if you really like PC games, I think it's one to give a shot, if only to kind of see where a lot of these like kind of roguelike tendencies started and became popular.
If you like Binding of Isaac,
kind
of any game in that vein, you'll play NetHack for like 10 minutes and you'll be like, oh, that's where this came from. You can really see the lineage pretty clearly, which is cool. And it's free.
It's free. And it feels cool to use PuTTY to like, command line interface.
You want to feel like a hacker.
Yeah. Do. Press Q to quaff. Like, there's a quaff action. Cool. So that's rad. Real quickly, I want to thank, we have Ronder, who just subscribed for 3 months in a row. So Ronder, thank you.
Thank you,
Ronder. Nice to have you. And I apologize for last week missing. I know Jules, I missed your subscription, and he called me out on it, and he chastised me for about an hour straight.
Well done.
It's 9 months, I think. 9 months Jules has been with. Correct me if I'm wrong.
You have to ask Jules.
Yeah, he's in the chat. I'm sure he'll correct me. So thanks, guys.
You want to talk about Lawbreakers?
I do. I want to talk about Good Bads and the...
the Ken Lawbreakers.
What does Evan call it? Police criminals. it's the new arena shooter from Bosky Studios. And
from Clifford B.
Clifford B, known industry figure.
I feel like this is maybe slightly sad, and I don't mean it to disparage Lawbreakers, but I feel like the game that we are going to play the most around Lawbreakers is coming up with funny ways to say Lawbreakers.
Yeah, it's the name of the game is renaming Lawbreakers.
But it's really fun, actually.
Yeah, it's so... I think a lot of the maybe disinterest or confusion, or I don't know what it is, around this game is not really knowing what it is. But I think at its essence is arena shooting, Unreal, and so on and so forth, defined by classes that have different weapons, some different abilities, and most importantly, I think, different kind of ways to move, different locomotion abilities. Mm-hmm. I can't remember how many classes there are. Like,
isn't it 12?
It's
12.
There's or a lot. There's quite a few. Just a couple archetypes. There's the Titan, which is a rocket launcher carrying character who moves, lumbers slowly through the map, but his rocket launcher is very powerful. If you can, you know, anticipate where a character is going to be and shoot them with it, it'll almost instantly
it's
kill
like,
them.
I just happened to see that it does like 225 damage.
A lot of damage.
Like on impact. And I think a lot of the characters are probably like 400 health or something.
Yeah.
So pretty big hit there.
It does the nice thing, and we won't do this for all the characters, but it does a nice thing where Doom's rocket launcher, the new, most recent Doom, if you right-clicked, you could explode the rocket on its trajectory whenever. So even if you're not going to bullseye someone, you can get some splash damages in by timing that
explosion.
Which
is really important for Lawbreakers, because a lot of the game has fast-moving characters, these areas with low gravity. So
yes.
You're kind of like people like flying in the air over your head. And if you had to hit them with the rocket, they're not very fast-moving rockets.
No.
So most of the characters, I think, could easily just dance around you and you'd be totally screwed. But being able to detonate them and kind of plan.
It's pretty satisfying. Yeah.
Works pretty well.
And that's like maybe one end of the spectrum, this big lumbering character who can't move quickly and, you know, has this weapon that kind of reflects that. On the other end of the spectrum, there's maybe something like the assassin or the, the wraith class, the assassin has this really cool, like, golden lasso is what I'll call it. And
Wonder Woman lasso.
Yeah, they whip it out and it attaches to a surface and they can swing around and gain momentum that way. The caveat is they don't have... I think they have a pistol for their secondary weapon. I might be wrong, but
I've only played a couple classes so far.
I'm awful with the assassin, so I'm don't play the assassin very much. But they have these swords, so two blades, and the goal of that is like to lasso people and like come at them quickly, boom, boom, and get out. That's one end of the spectrum. The other, you know, and there's like all these archetypes in between like there's almost like a Soldier 76 style rifleman who.
That's the guy. That Evan suggested I start with just to like get a feel for the game, and that is what I did. I only played like two or three classes, and that was definitely a very easy one to get into for a game that moves so quickly and has so much. I guess it doesn't have as much going on as a game like Overwatch in terms of the number of abilities like popping out all the time. It doesn't have that like MOBA feel, but it does just have a lot of speed happening. It's objective based, so you have to know what the objectives are. You have to deal with the anti-grav stuff. So having a character who is kind of straightforward, Soldier 76, Call of Duty almost kind of guy. It's just like, you got a machine gun, you got a grenade, aim well, and you're going to do okay.
So I think fairly it gets compared to Overwatch, and in the marketing kind of, or at least the lead up to the game's release, got compared to Overwatch. Why? Because Overwatch is kind of the shooter everyone plays now.
I mean, it sold like 20 million copies.
Yeah.
It's inevitable that they're going to be kind of compared, put up against
each other. And, I mean... You look at like some of the archetypes and of the characters, and if you look at the fact that there's essentially almost identical loot box system, it's a different name. They're called stash crates or loot stashes, or I don't know.
The word stash is in there somewhere. Yeah,
they give you character skins and. boot imprints, because if you melee somebody, if you kick somebody to death, it'll leave a boot imprint on their screen, so you can leave your signature in someone's face. Gun stickers and some other things like that, gun skins. But I think it's important to distinguish them, because whereas Overwatch requires like is heavily leans on team synergies and cooperative play. Lawbreakers does benefit from playing as a team and, like, you know, understanding the rhythm.
Any team-based game.
Yeah, obviously. Right, yeah. Like, they're, you know, communicating, positioning, and, like, where you're doing, and staying together generally is good. But Lawbreakers, it's about shooting the thing that's moving, right? It's not about these amazing team combinations of, you know, I'm popping my super and you're popping your super. And that stuff can come in handy. There was some times, like, where I was playing the Battle Medic, who... Their super just pops this big bubble shield, and there's one match type or a couple match types where you're guarding a point, where you need to sit on a point for a certain amount of time to either
kind of a King of the Hill style node control.
And popping that bubble shield while another character class, the Harrier class, I think, their special is this like laser of death,
that giant laser beam.
Yeah, that they will do a lot of damage very quickly. I popped that at the right time. That was like. That was good. That was like, oh, yeah, I can see how some of these...
You were real satisfied with yourself last night when you did that.
It's so funny. There's this video. If Evan's watching, he should link to his... He just linked to his clip from the game last night. I'm like, in the background, I'm like so excited about this rocket kill I got. I'm like, oh, my God, I killed a guy with a rocket. I'm so... Oh, it was amazing. And meanwhile, Evan's just silent and killing like... four dudes and scoring two goals. Anyway, it's the small things for me.
Yeah, so going back to what you were saying about it being a game more directly about shoot the person in front of you, as much as it does help to have your team and, you know, the better your opponents, the more it matters to have, you know, a cohesive team together. On the flip side of that is you can watch Evan watch a clip of Evan playing and or play with Evan and hear him just say, you know, killed two, killed three, like yeah. got three are down, three are dead. And it's like, okay, if one person has the skill and is good with their class yeah. and makes the use of those abilities, they can, you know, they can get the kills that then enable other people on the team to go score the objective or whatever it is.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
of course, teamwork's important, but it has that satisfaction of an arena shooter where
yes.
you're just aiming really tightly, you're meleeing at the right time, you're dodging well, and that's what keeps you alive.
Yeah, any class, two classes going head-to-head, I mean, on a spreadsheet might not look evenly matched, but the outcome is almost always just going to be who can point and click better and move their dude around the right way.
I think Lawbreakers makes a nice kind of midpoint between the newer hero shooter school yeah. of design and the older arena shooter design, which is every character has a couple of abilities, and so you can build teams around the way those pair together or use ones that you think are right for the right map or the mm-hmm. right mode or whatever, but you only have a couple of abilities. The focus is still much more on the shooting.
Yeah.
And you're going to have one ability that you can use every few seconds, you know, and then you have one like ultimate ability and that you're going to only use every minute or so.
Yeah.
And then your kind of your third ability is a movement skill. So that is an interesting twist that gives each class sort of its own style of movement. You can choose the one that you really like, what fits your play style well, but that move isn't like a thing that you need to be constantly aware of about your
yeah.
opponent in the way that, you know, oh, they have this shield or they have this counter or they have this bomb or whatever that they're going to throw at me.
It's not.
So you kind of yeah. only have to know like the one or two things each class is going to do up against it.
But yeah, it's not often that it's like it's rare that a super ability is going to wipe your team than, you know, in Overwatch if someone uses it skillfully. So I think it's really good, and I'm kind of bummed to hear this the narrative surrounding it of calling it a failure, deeming it a failure before, you know, after like a week or two. I'm the player count is not high. I don't know what healthy is. Like, I'm not going to sit here and tell, like, guess what a healthy player count or what they projected. I would imagine they want more people playing it because
I think that's always
yeah
always
absolutely
yeah.
I mean, it's enough of a problem that I can't tell if I just don't like certain objective types or if just the matchmaking is too, if the matchmaking itself is the problem or the player population is keeping, you know, who we can be matched with to a certain, you know, subset of people.
We definitely had some hard swings.
Yeah.
When we played last
night. Yeah. It was just getting our ass kicked supremely a couple matches in a row. And then finally finding a group that was somewhere around our skill level. And on the way, running into some of the same players I saw from the night prior. So it feels a little tight-knit right now. I think it's very refreshing to me because those losses, I was not infuriated in the same way I am with a class-based, like a more heavily class-based game like Overwatch. I feel like anytime I play Overwatch with a group of friends and we lose a couple in a row, you can clearly lay blame on, you can sort of point to, well, that moment or that character or that player who is not performing that class role very well. And I mean, the same can be said for Lawbreakers. Like, you look at my KD, it's not the best. It ain't the best, but it's harder to point to specific moments and like, you know, when two teams are going at it, where it's clear who failed and why.
So you're saying it's not that you didn't fulfill your function.
It's that
just,
no one can know.
You just were not good enough.
Yeah, the evidence is not yeah. there to criminalize me.
Yeah, I think it's a fun game. I think some of the objective types could probably use
yeah.
some work. Some of them are very similar to each other.
A little too similar.
Some match times are maybe a little too long. But one thing I thought was interesting is I believe there is not a team deathmatch mode period in the game, or like maybe you can set it up in
a custom
game or something,
yeah.
but it's not in the matchmaking. I could be wrong about that, but I think Evan said that when we were playing yesterday. I believe, and we only played objective game types.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that was surprising coming from kind of the lineage of Unreal Tournament, right? And thinking back to when I used to play a lot of Halo 2 and Halo 3 and Halo 1 on PC to some extent, but mostly like in my Halo 2 and Halo 3 days, playing on Xbox Live, I loved objective game types. I loved Capture the Flag. I loved Assault, like Bomb. Those were the ones that I really wanted to play. And those playlists were always much, much, much less populated than Team Deathmatch. I felt like about 75% of the population wanted to just do Deathmatch.
Yeah.
And then a few people actually wanted to play CTF or one of these other modes. And that always bummed me out because I loved like the team organization that it took to do well in the CTF mode. I loved just like the way that changed how you had to use the maps and just everything that went into that. And I think it's interesting that Overwatch has kind of swung that the other way, in that Overwatch is a purely objective game and that has become the go-to. But I don't think I like these, like, the new popular objective modes as much as I kind of like, or maybe I'm just nostalgic for classic two flag, two base CTF. And so on the one hand, I'm like, it's really cool that this new shooter is not focusing on deathmatch, is focusing on objective gameplay. But I don't know if I like these objective modes as much as I like just classic, like, attack and defense objective.
I think I appreciate Overwatch's, I mean, it fits into Overwatch's, you know, more role-based.
It's a lot simpler. It's more focused.
Yeah. And you can kind of clearly point to each class and look at them as, like, you know, distinct players on in a football game or in a, you know, and whereas it, in a shooting game about shooting, it's a mishmash of those roles, and it's more frenetic and sort of less pointed, but it's more energetic to me, and more when you're in it. I think, I don't know, it feels more by, you're getting by on skinnier teeth more often from moment to moment.
Definitely,
and it leads to some more, I think, like if you watch any of Evan's clips, just crazy, crazy displays of skill. And those are, you can get some of that in Overwatch and similar games, but it's usually like a well-timed super or, you know, these kind of more stricter conditions, butting heads. And
I think maybe the ability, the kind of advent of abilities in these team based FPS kind of pushed them away from team deathmatch. Cause I think the timing of when you use those skills and like the importance of them adds this kind of strategic element that isn't as relevant when it's just kill each other. You know, like makes way more sense to know when to use your ability and when to use your ult, you know, on this King of the Hill moment or this, you know, last push on the cart or whatever it is. But when you're just like in a hallway and there's two guys there, like less interesting, less dynamic. Right. But I still wish Lawbreakers had a team deathmatch mode. Just
it seems weird
just to learn, like, OK, I just want to focus on like how do I play this character and shoot dudes, and then I'll go into the objective mode.
Exactly.
So maybe that's in customs. And if it is, we should play some team deathmatch.
We should. It's worth noting DJ Bruce points out that Overwatch is actually getting team deathmatch.
Yeah, so they are adding that, which is cool. Thanks for pointing that out. It's only been like a year and 4 months or something since it came out. I forget exactly how long.
Yeah.
But that'll be interesting to see in Overwatch if that's fun and what the player base is there.
I agree. I mean, closing thoughts on Lawbreakers. I mean, I just kind of want to point out again that don't listen to the narrative around, like, it seems to be popular to hate on this game, and you may not like Cliffy B, and that's fine, and you may not like arena shooters, and that's fine. You may not like its aesthetics, and that's fine. It's pretty dopey, and as we play it, we make fun of it constantly. But it's a good shooter. If you like arena shooting with some added variables and, you know, lightly class based stuff, but not, you know, like required meta you know, dictionary knowledge, it's good. And
I think there are fewer people hating on it than just people who just kind of think it's DOA.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose that's what I'm trying to get at.
And on the scale of big, successful multiplayer games these days, it kind of is, you know? Like, but I think that's going to be a continuing struggle in games, as there are going to be more and more of these games that are... have 10 million people playing them, like more Battlegrounds, more Overwatches. Yes. And then for everyone else, which leaves a lot of people, it's going to be a struggle to get a community of, you know, an active 10,000 players or something like that.
And, yeah.
And those are games that if you like what they're about, if you like how they play, you know, just because they only have 1,000 people online, don't write them off, because then they will die.
Exactly.
But if it's a game like Lawbreakers that you think is fun, give it a shot and see if you like it.
$30. It's worth saying that just like arena shooters, I think going forward, because the market is so saturated for competitive games overall, which tend to be shooters and, you know, and MOBAs, I think it's possible, and maybe they were just before this started becoming clearer, that arena shooters that don't have the same kind of, I don't know, prolonged meta story unfolding and like clear competitive kind of hallmarks to them, or at least like class-based, like role-based things that you can keep track of and monitor and like kind of understand quickly. I still think it's possible for arena shooters like Lawbreakers. And another example is Dusk, which, PC Gamer Club members turned freelancer, freelance writer, Buttface Jones, Norm. He wrote up this game called Dusk, which is, it's coming with a multiplayer mode, and it's an indie game. It's like very small, but what they've done is cultured a Discord community of about 1,000 people over the game's development, and they're designing this multiplayer mode to exist in basically that community and support that community.
That's really cool.
So, you know, it may never have the player count of an Overwatch. It never will. Well, maybe Dusk will. That'd be rad. But it will be able to sustain itself through, you know, that kind of close, curated community interaction. I think maybe Lawbreakers missed out on that, or maybe they tried and just couldn't get it going, or maybe they have done that and they will be able to support themselves over time by, you know, curating a community for this of X thousand for this, you know, unique arena style shooter. So
I think it actually would be impossible, but illuminating to look up historical data on player counts for FPS games in like the 90s, early 2000s. I don't think that data exists probably, but I'd be curious to know how many people were playing relatively successful popular shooters like Castle Wolfenstein. I forget which version of that was especially popular. It was the spinoff on Return to Castle Wolfenstein, or it was there's Enemy Territory.
Yeah, there's a couple of them.
There's a lot of shooters from that era that were kind of popular multiplayer only games, right? Quake 3, of course, and some of them, of course, sold millions of copies. But I bet some of them probably only had a couple thousand people online at any given time, and that was fine.
Then,
but now that we have stuff like Steam charts showing us, you know, the exact population of a game and be like, oh, it started at 20,000, but now there's only 900 people playing it. Like, this game's dead. And it's like, well, maybe 900 people playing isn't that bad. Or maybe it is. I don't know. I'd like to be able to compare.
I think it's become a trend to look at the Steam chart, like top 100 games, and use that as a metric for success. Like, if you're not on your multiplayer game, you're not on the top 100, you're a failure, which isn't necessarily true. Certainly for a game like, under Clifford B's, creative supervision, and there's been so many parody, like, kind of videos poking fun at the guy for all the things he said throughout the years, and, you know, it's going to be a $1 billion franchise and so on. It's not meeting those expectations, certainly,
but it's pretty fun.
Yeah, it's cool.
I really want to follow Dusk's success and see what it's like kind of building a game for that small community first and seeing if it grows from there.
It looks really cool. You can do flips. It's a first-person shooter where you can do flips. Think about that. Quake-style shooter.
Does it make you throw up?
I don't know. I have not done many flips in it, but it looks rad.
Because Mirror's Edge got me a little queasy once or twice with the acrobatics in that game.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see.
But I love Mirror's Edge.
So yeah, that's one game we've been playing. Anything else you've been playing, Wes?
So I played a little bit of this game last night that I just stumbled upon on itch.io. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember what I was looking for. I was trying to look something up and ended up on this game called Pioneers on itch.io. And lately I've had like the Oregon Trail and the other trail games like the Amazon Trail just in my head for whatever reason. We were thinking about streaming those sometime, which might be fun. And I came across this game that's like a strategy or like a turn-based RPG strategy game set at like the 1500s with you as an explorer in the New World, basically.
That's rad.
And I was like, what? This sounds cool. And I really liked the art style. It has this cute pixel art. And so I was like, I'm just going to give this a shot. And so I downloaded it and tried it out and only played a little bit, probably about 45 minutes or so, which kind of got through a tutorial part and stocked up on some equipment to go out adventuring. But it has a fun sense of style to it. It has some nice art, very simple, but nice art. And I kind of dig it.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool. Just glancing at it, I kind of miss that era of game. So, and it's worth noting, if you were here for the intro, the tunes we were playing are from this game.
Yeah, I don't know if that song was like all right, but there was one other one, I don't know the name of it.
Yeah.
That played while I was playing it last night, and I was like, this is really good.
Well, when I cut the show together, I'll put that one at the front.
Put some good music in there. Sweet. But yeah, you just like go into these towns, and you can recruit adventurers to go with you on your journey, and then you go out, and I don't really know what a journey entails yet because I haven't gotten that far, but it's a free game on itch.io, or you can pay whatever you want for it, and it hasn't been updated in a couple years, but I think it's still potentially in development, so who knows if it will ever be finished, but it seems pretty playable right
cool.
now, so
cool.
Check it out if you kind of want that vibe of an Oregon Trail style game, but without the blatant educational element to it.
Right on. I want to talk about, and this game is now not out on PC yet, I should note, but I want to talk about this classic character we all know and love, Sonic the Hedgehog.
Sonic
the Hedgehog.
The Shedgehog.
Sonic the Hedgehog. Wes, what's your experience with Sonic?
I was all about Sonic as a kid.
Yeah.
My parents wouldn't buy me a game console when I was a kid. And they wouldn't let me spend my money on it because my money was like savings for later in life, you know? But every year, sort of a family friend, like, you know, would call her an aunt basically, would rent me a Sega Genesis on my birthday, because that was the kind of thing you could do at the time, is rent games from Blockbuster or whatever the local rental place. And so we would rent a Sega Genesis, and I would always rent Sonic 1 at first, and then one of the later Sonic games. And years later, like when the N64 had come out, I got a hand-me-down Genesis from my cousin. And played a ton of Sonic, and I really liked the first three games, specifically Sonic 3, I think is my favorite, but I like 2 and 3 a lot. The first one's pretty stiff once you go back to it, but I like those old Sonic games, and I have played quite a few of the 3D ones since then. I liked Sonic Adventure 2 at the time when I played it, but now I think all those games are pretty trashy.
Yeah, they're awful.
There hasn't been a good one since Sonic 3 and Knuckles.
Generations had good moments,
okay,
because they went just 2D with some of them, but then they would be like,
even the ones that people are like, Sonic's good again, like Sonic Colors, the 3D platformer.
Get out of here.
Nah, or 2D, here. It was like 2.5D, right? Not very good.
No.
The Sonic Advance games actually were solid. I played those. Those were straight
pretty,
2D.
Pretty good.
Those are okay. But yeah, I like old Sonic.
Me too.
And don't care about new
Sonic.
I get
my experience is a little different. I can't articulate the differences between them, but I only ever played Sonic PC games. I didn't ever have a Genesis or
Sonic
anything.
Sonic 3D Blast on PC?
I did play Sonic 3D Blast.
I bought Sonic 3D Blast on the PC.
I got it from one of those Scholastic book orders or something. It was
Sonic was not meant to be isometric.
Not at all. It was
not a good
idea. That
game idea.
Is pretty bad, but I still beat it.
I could not beat that game.
It's a weird, bizarre thing. Look it up. It's strange. I played Sonic CD primarily, which, and chat, correct me if I'm wrong, or at least like help me out here. As far as I know, Sonic CD is not exactly a straight compilation of the three Sonic games.
Definitely not.
It's more of like a...
It has unique levels.
Yeah, it has unique levels. It's like a unique game overall, and...
It has different movement mechanics slightly.
Yeah, yeah.
It has the weird like time travel thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sonic CD was an interesting one where I think it was one of those games at the time that people talked up as being great because it had it was super rare. Right. Mm-hmm. Like nobody had a Sega CD.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody had this game. And so it was kind of spoken of in whispers as like, oh, that's the best Sonic game. And then I think once more people played it, it maybe lost a bit of that prestige.
Sure. Sure. That's basically my experience. I only played those games and I remember enjoying them a lot. My brother and I tore up Sonic CD. We played through it so many times. So I like Sonic. I'm not like the 3D games. I've never really ever gotten attached to them. And I, too, was in the camp that never really thought Sonic could, like, that Sega had lost touch and Sonic was kind of just done for. And,
you know, even at the best of times, like, yeah. He was never close to as good as Mario.
No.
In terms of, like, a platformer design.
No.
Nowhere close.
No. And
but still fun enough.
Still fun. Like, it was, those original games, like, were about momentum and sort of these big maze-like levels where you would play through them twice and based on like where you either choose to go or how much speed you accumulate, you could find cool secrets or alternate pathways. And it was at least a thrill. They got bogged down by like more precision based stuff. And you know, I don't think that's,
yeah, there wasn't a lot of good precision. And
no, all this is to say that, it's not on a PC yet. It got delayed on PC, but Sonic Mania is here and I got it. I got the Sonic Mania
and it's okay.
You've
contracted it. How's your temperature?
I have been sweating. I have been seeing blue hedgehogs when I close my eyes.
You're on speed.
Sonic
James.
Mania fucking rules.
It's that good.
It's the best. It's better than any of the original Sonic games.
Ooh.
So far. I mean, like again, I shouldn't say that because my experience with the. Again, Sonic CD, so it's like an enhanced version of the three original games. I can't really speak to the Genesis experience, but I think it is the best designed Sonic game, the most charming, and on track to be just the most fun overall. Again, delayed on PC, comes out later this month. It was supposed to come out.
I think it got delayed 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
So that means it's probably about slightly less than 2 weeks away now.
Yeah, I've been playing it on Switch, so you know I can't comment on how it'll run on PC or like why it got delayed or, you know, but I assume it's going to be fine. I assume it's fine. It's just, you know, developing games for a lot of platforms is tough.
And what makes it the best?
Well, okay, it's the best because. It knows what people loved about the original games. And that was, like we were talking about, going fast and experiencing these big kind of levels full of weird gizmos and crazy sprites and really good music. And it like kind of doubles down on that stuff. So
you don't buy into the modern theory that actually Sonic was never about going fast.
Oh, fuck that shit. Who says that?
People who hold up the level design of the classic games, as platformers over the modern 3D ones. I think it's about how you go fast.
Right. And I think it's...
And the 3D games kind of lost sight of how going fast could be fun
in
the design of a level. It was just like boost pads.
And, just shooting you through in like a level and kind of spitting you out the other end. Have a lot of sections that are just about gathering momentum and watching Sonic do loops and spin through these crazy contraptions and whatnot. And I think that's how they're most entertaining. As there are bits of platforming, some old problems, legacy problems that still hold up, is like in the second level, there's a bit where you get tossed underwater. And if you know underwater Sonic levels,
sweet,
not great. That great, you know, you're about to die sound is back. And it requires you to do some precision platforming, like jump on this tiny pad, but it feels like you're basically throwing a giant, like making Sonic jump and with precision feels like you're tossing a big bag of marbles or something
underwater.
Yeah. You're just like, ugh, go that way. It's never been about that. And it has very few moments where that's like important. These levels are, every single level I've played introduces a unique spin or gadget or gimmick.
Nice
spin, fuck. I won't spoil them because I think it's interesting to find them. That's like one of the best parts so far has been. But early on, I will say, there are basically like monkey bars in one level, and it's fun to, the joy comes from like gathering momentum on your loop-de-loops and kind of finding your route through the level and like gathering momentum, but chaining that together with whatever these gizmos are. So these monkey bars, you might like shoot through a level, you see monkey bars in your periphery, and you're like, oh, I know I'm gonna have to grab those, or I could, and you'll shoot up to them and do a quick like doot.
That's totally a Sonic 3 and Knuckles thing, by the way.
Oh, is it? Monkey Bar?
That's
okay.
In there, yeah. But I'm sure
there are further... Yeah.
They're doing more with it.
They activate switches, and they kind of have weird like enemy interactions. There are some like hazards, like these flamethrowers that can be if used as bounce pads, if you know.
Also a classic Sonic
thing. God damn it. I'm speaking on the early levels, but there are I don't want to say bars. I'll just say like bar stools is a thing. It plays around with like, just trust me here is what I'm saying. But, there's even bits where it's like, it becomes a little bit more like puzzle solvey. Like you'll have to learn how to change the property of Sonic's movement state. If that makes sense, using ice or something. And, basically make a path for him to gain momentum. So you might like chill in an area for a bit, chill ice. And
you're on fire.
God damn it. And you might have to, destroy certain blocks or like find switches that rearrange properties of the level in order to then like go back up to the top and activate something that changes the way Sonic behaves and shoot yourself through this like kind of gauntlet you set up.
That sounds cool.
Yeah. So it changes pacing in so many different ways. The bosses have so far been really, really cool. One, I don't want to spoil them either, but one basically turns Sonic into a completely different game. It just basically says you're gonna play this now, and it's gonna be a boss, and it'll be familiar to people, I think, but it's just hilarious.
Does it turn him into Bubsy? Because that's what happens.
No, a totally different genre of game.
Okay.
So it's so cheeky and silly and playful. The environments are just like, there's so much beautiful sprite work happening in the backgrounds. There's one where I forget what it's called. Like TV, some kind of TV.
That's the thing that's really appealed to me is just seeing how much unique animation and artwork they've done for this game and how well they've remixed old elements. And
absolutely. So there's a lot of remixed elements. There's a lot of like new, like even the Green Hill Zone, every asset you see is brand new. So I played this like a year ago at PAX, and I talked to some of the producers, and every single thing is brand new. It's not like they're recycling sprites. Even if they're using a similar design, they're making it again from scratch.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
If people who are interested in it, I would recommend watching Digital Foundry's video about Sonic Mania that they put up in the last couple of days. They do a lot of, you know, performance analysis and stuff of games, but they also run a really fun series called DF Retro, where they look at older games. And this new video they did on Sonic Mania has some really fun comparisons with the original Sonic games and digging into how like sprite work stuff worked on the Genesis, what they're doing in this game that is different, what they're doing to make it look like the old game, but actually like adding in elements that would not have worked on the old console. And that stuff's really fun, and they are very knowledgeable about this stuff. So their breakdown's really cool.
That's awesome. So yeah, just closing thoughts. I think it's if you ever doubted Sonic and you used to have a fondness for the game, the series, this is like your best shot at, you know, getting back into it.
And how good is this opening intro?
This opening intro is amazing. It's so fucking good. And this kind of style and attitude is just there throughout every single, it's just all about goofy fun.
And
it's never
the score is all like with this wonderful jazzy music. Oh, it's not the 2000s era butt rock that Sonic has become legendary for.
No, the music is amazing. Like I will buy the soundtrack when it comes out.
I bought the vinyl.
There's one song on there for one of the, I don't know how many levels there are, but I'm 5 or 6 in, that is, it's a song you can make love to. I mean, every Sonic game ever, or Sonic song ever, is one you can make love to all of them. But this song in particular, I was literally like, damn.
Challenge accepted.
I was like, damn, what are they going for here? Anyway, Sonic Mania.
They know exactly what they're going for. They know their fan base.
They know. They're dumb.
You know the new 3D Sonic game has a create a hedgehog mode.
It is just like Sonic Boom.
They have finally integrated DeviantArt into a Sonic game. Like it took them long enough. Like they should have seen the potential there 10 years ago, but finally they've acknowledged.
How bizarre is it that like this amazing Sonic game? I should mention that this is also like, this game was, I think one reason it's so good is because it was put together by a lot of people who basically made Sonic fan games in the past or worked on ports. Christian Whitehead is one figure to point out. I think he did.
They came out of the fan game community, absolutely.
Yeah. So the people who love and know Sonic best, I think, made this game. And it's promising because if we can get just an ongoing series that kind of does this and continually like introduces new ideas, I think Sonic is back.
What do you call the sequel to Sonic Mania? You go in a totally different direction.
Sonic Insanity, Sonic Madness.
Are you trying to one up it?
I don't know. It's a good question.
The insane Sonic Posse.
Jesus Christ.
And Knuckles.
I think Knuckles is already sort of a juggalo, but that's my headcanon.
That's a conversation for another day.
but check it out when it comes out. If you're on the fence, I wholeheartedly recommend it. Sonic Mania. One last game I want to give a shout out in our prolonged what we've been playing is, and let me since everyone's yelling at me to change the topic, I'll do it. West of Loathing. Not West of Loathing.
I have not touched this yet, but it sounds delightful.
Yeah, West of Loathing is the new game. I'm forgetting the
Kingdom studio. Of Loathing.
It's basically the sequel or the spiritual sequel. It's another entry in the series of Loathing series.
Turn-based RPG, is that right?
Turn-based RPG. The Kingdom of Loathing was a medieval kind of like fantasy stick comedy RPG, and West of Loathing is a Western take on that. And I just want to like echo Chris's, check out Chris's review on our site, pcgamer.com/reviews. It's up there pretty recently. He really liked it a lot. And
that man knows comedy.
That man, he's hilarious. So if it's got the Chris seal of approval, it's a must. It's only like $12 or something like that. And I think you can get like 20 hours out of this. And almost all of that is pretty funny and worthwhile.
And that's hard.
That's really hard.
That's really hard.
Games that try to be funny are often not very funny. I like to point to maybe games that try too hard, like Saints Row, or some of those games have good comedic elements, but I think overall kind of fall more than they succeed.
And there's a lot of bad parody games out there that
Matt
are like,
Hazard.
We make fun of the tropes of RPGs. And
yes,
like a shitty RPG that just goes, haha, look at this shitty thing we did that other games do too.
And West of Loathing is a good RPG. It's very lightweight and pretty easy, but it is successful in making a combat system that is, it's never like, if it kicks your ass, like, you know why, mm-hmm. and you'll respawn and you'll have to like, you lose a day. There's no like timer, but you might lose effects from the day that you've gathered or stat boost from the day. And that's like your penalty. And you have to go back, you know, you go back to your main inn, but then you can just go back and fight whatever the giant yeast monster and have
that's
another go
a,
at it.
That's a thing I'd like to fight.
Yeah. But it's essentially broken down by this map. You kind of wander and find locations, and each location sort of has a shtick or a small story attached to it. And it's fun to like explore a cave full of goblins that are, well, a better example might be like an abandoned pickle factory. It's actually haunted, and there are ghosts there that and sentient ghost pickles that attack you. And it's like, it's not trying to lampoon anything. It's not really like, it's just ridiculous, right? It's not like South Park where it's like, oh, it's Nazi fetuses and isn't that edgy? Oh my gosh. And you know,
that is so edgy,
right? It's like, it's trying to like poke at your comfort level, but West of Loathing just wants to be endearing and delightful and say, why not? Not kind of deliberately invoke ire from people. And I think, you know, you might be able to enjoy South Park for that kind of thing, but it's not my cup of tea. West of Loathing is just, it's there to make you feel happy and chuckle
so
for 20 hours.
Funnier than Blazing Saddles, yes or no?
it's kind of hard to talk Blazing Saddles, but I think it successfully channels sort of that wacky comedy, Western comedy.
Another great one if you love Western comedies is Cat Ballou. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. It's a real good one. Look it up.
Look it up. Well, Wes knows his stuff, so I trust that recommendation. Anything else we've been playing, Wes?
I think I'm about tapped out.
I'm about tapped out, too. So with that, Wes Fabus says, West of Loathing is a game of dad jokes. That's not far from the truth. With that, we're going to open it up to Twitch chat Q&A. So what that means is if you're in the chat right now, you can shoot us a question. Make sure you tag at PC Gamer in your question. Otherwise, we're going to just totally miss it. The chat tends to scroll by quickly, and it's hard to keep track of otherwise. We will favor people who are subscribers to our Twitch channel, so we'll answer those questions first. Or if you're a club member, I asked for questions already. I'm not going to be like browsing our Discord at the moment because it's kind of hard to switch back and forth. But if you provided questions in the Discord in our club, thank you very much. If you are interested in joining our Discord, which is just a good-ass time, and we play games a lot together. You can go to club.pcgamer.com for more information on that. There's some really cool stuff you get in the club.
We have a trivia bot now.
Oh, we have a trivia bot.
Main reason to subscribe.
Yeah.
It's a very tiny, small reason.
It's popular though. There's people in it all the time. And you added a bunch of new questions and a Jeopardy mode you've been testing.
I found a site that had. So basically we have a trivia channel in the Discord. You can go in, start trivia, play with other people, compete. It's fun. Trivia has a bunch of categories, but I wanted to get some Jeopardy questions in there. And I found a site that had archived about 30 years worth of Jeopardy TV, like every episode. And then someone else had crawled that site and dumped all of the questions and answers and extraneous data into this one giant file.
God damn.
And a friend of mine who's a programmer helped me just like pull the questions and answers out of that giant list and put it into a text file, which is what the trivia bot reads. And I had to split it up because there were 20,000 questions and it would take it about a minute to load half of those. So it's kind of carved up, but if you want to try your Jeopardy medal in the trivia bot, the questions are in there. Give it 20 seconds to load the questions.
Takes a bit. It's a lot.
Because there's still 5,000 questions per question segment that I added up. But there's also a gaming category, and there's not one dedicated specifically to PC games yet, but I'm going to get that in there eventually.
Yep.
That will be our go-to.
It's a good time. Yeah, so for more information, in chat I posted club.pcgamer.com, ad-free experience on the site, digital magazine subscription, free games. I give away games all the time in the Discord. So we gave away some shirts the other day, too, some pretty cool shirts.
And sometimes you can get a shirt that James has worn.
Yeah, I did wear one of them. So some lucky suckers got my sweat and musk and a little bit of blood. There's no blood on it. on that shirt. Enjoy it. Enjoy it. I can bleed on you. If you DM me, I will. I got special services. Whoa. We got some questions, though. I'm going to pop into the Discord questions real quick. So earlier, RockSolid32 asked, and this is kind of an interesting one. We're not going to give away, or we don't know all the answers here, but with the slow, steady decline of magazine subscriptions and print in general, how is PC Gamer slash Future Publishing doing financially? Has the recent move to online subscription and web ads staved off any concerns from falling subscriptions? Or is the supremacy of PC Gamer immune from any kind of publishing or financial concerns? Or do writers even pay attention to such things? Thanks. So, I mean, we're not going to comment on financially how we're doing, because a lot of that stuff, like, we don't know about. Even if we did, it's not like cool to share all that stuff. It's weird to me.
I don't think we know.
We don't know
many details of like, on the high level, but I mean, the company's doing okay.
Yeah, we're doing pretty well.
I think every magazine probably in the world sells less copies than they did in 2005. Yes. Or whatever. Like, you are right that the magazine industry is a lot smaller than it used to be. But we're doing better. Like, we've been growing online every year, for the past, for many years. As long as we've worked here, it's been growing a lot. So that helps.
Yeah. The whenever you hear someone like who's angry at games media say, you're dead in the water, you guys are failing. It's like, for us, that's not true at all.
And the magazine still, like, people still buy the magazine. Yeah. It's still successful.
I think we're not just going to like not address that. That's why you have a digital subscription to the mag, and PCGamer.com is going to grow and change over time.
We're always
time.
Trying to come up with new ways to grow, for sure.
Yeah. So dead in the water, not at all. We're doing fine. PC Gamer, as you know it, will not always be what it is as you know it, in terms of like as a magazine and a website. And those two may not exist side by side in the same way forever, but we're all going to be here and we're still going to be writing about games and enjoying it.
I mean, someday we'll just be like some kind of brain feed.
Yeah,
like,
we're going to be a magazine. There's going to be a server somewhere.
You can just have James underwater imported into your head.
Oh, God forbid. earlier, Butts or DJ Bruce asked, I don't know how to parse
this.
How do you feel about games that put you in unwinnable situations? And how has it improved your love of a game or unhindered it? And I mean, that's kind of hard for me to understand.
I think there are different ways you can interpret that. Like, one of the first things I think of is kind of an art, like a JRPG trope, where you have that battle that you can't win against like the tough enemy. And you're like, oh, why is this battle so hard? I can't beat him. And then when they finally kick your ass, it just like goes to a cutscene and you're like, oh, I was supposed to lose that fight. I think that's a really bad mechanic, because a lot of times it doesn't account for how strong you your party might be a little stronger than the game intends, so you like last for 15 minutes in this fight before you just give up out of frustration. Or you expect that you're supposed to lose a fight and then you get a game over when you lose it and you're like, what the hell? Mm-hmm. I think that's bad design. But then there's another way you could interpret this as saying it's about like something Telltale Games do, for example, where you have to choose between two characters and one of them's going to die. And so that's kind of a like, that's a no-win situation, right? Mm-hmm. Someone is going to die and you have to decide which one. And I think that can be a powerful narrative moment if it's done well.
I think both situations like are... what I like about games is being put under pressure to make a choice or to press on. Dark Souls, again, every week Dark Souls, it's the easy example, right? It'll put a boss might one hit you like the very first time you go against it, but if it's one of the better bosses or you've learned anything along the way, it's that you can probably come away knowing something new about the situation, or at least like prepare differently, or, you know, and that to me is like that perseverance is interesting. And the same with, similarly with a narrative choice, if the writing is well, it's feeling the weight of losing a character or affecting the world, in an irreversible way that's pretty cool. I think it's one of the best things about games, in my opinion.
There's a moment in the first season of The Walking Dead that, a character death that is like one of the most affecting moments I've had for making you feel powerless, and like the way it manipulates their so-and-so will remember this mechanic. I've people have written about, and is a really powerful moment in that season, and is probably my favorite bit in The Walking Dead.
It's so good.
Without spoiling anything.
Yeah, go play it if you have not. This one's for US. Oh, well, first I want to acknowledge that Mildo's asked us about competitive shooters in the next 2 years. We sort of like accidentally talked about his question.
We probably talked about that.
Yeah. So thanks for the question, but we're gonna skip that one. Hopefully we answered it already in our chat about Lawbreakers. But Buttfish Jones asks, Wes, in your real actual life, do you think you'll continue to delid your CPUs, or is the hassle risk not worth the benefit outside of extreme overclocking?
Good question. For those who don't know what this is about, you can look on PC Gamer, do like a Google search for PC Gamer delidding. I took the top off my CPU a couple months ago, put on a much better thermal paste, reassembled it to get lower temperatures on my CPU. And would I do it? Will I continue doing it? I don't see why not. But I'm probably not going to switch out my home PC's CPU for quite a while, like, you know, 5+ years. So the only reason I wouldn't do it the next time I get a new CPU is if it doesn't work with the tool that I have. It's a tool developed by a member of the overclocking community. And my guess is the design of the next CPU I end up upgrading to in 3 to 5 years, 8 years, who knows how long, will probably have a slightly different layout and would require a different tool to safely take the lid off. So if that's the case, I might not bother with it. But it's a pretty easy process, and I don't think I would just do it for a friend that I built a PC for unless they were a real enthusiast. Like, I helped a friend build a PC last weekend, actually, and he's not the kind of guy who's going to be trying to overclock the CPU like crazy and like want to get as much possible performance out of it. So I probably wouldn't do it for that, because it's adding in a lot of time and effort and just being very careful with the process. So it's not something I would do every day, but for people who want that high performance, and including me, then hell yeah. Like, it's a fun little project. It's a little scary, but now that I've done it once, I feel pretty confident I could do it again without breaking anything. So
cool.
Yeah, I recommend it to anyone who is pretty tech savvy and wants to get really good overclocking temps on their CPU.
Awesome. I might have to do that next time I build one.
I got the tool.
All right. Jules asks, Jules M, sorry, forgot the M. As per the article about potential brain damage caused by FPS games, if there ever was real good proof that video games make you dumb, would you game less or differently, or are you going to be a gamer for life? So this is referring to a news story. I'll see if I can find the link in a second, but that essentially said that some first-person shooter games, studies concluded that, or at least linked, like decay in some kind of gray matter in the brain, linked it to playing first-person shooters and how you, and affecting how you remember space and spaces and have spatial reasoning. And I mean, that study is interesting, but it, the effect of the net effect of like isn't devastating. It's not like going to make it impossible for you to navigate a house or anything. So
that'd be sad.
I think that's like the important thing to take away from that is that
then you couldn't play Gone Home either.
Yeah. We would all be super lost. Like, all gamers would be like, oh shit, where am I all the time? If that was the case. If there ever was like a study that, you know, linked some kind of actual noticeable effect on our brain, then yeah, I probably would do something about that. I mean, I wouldn't be like, and there might even be some kind of regulation or law or something that comes in to accommodate, you know, that kind of thing.
I would definitely change my habits. I mean,
yeah,
it's hard to imagine like what the specifics of this circumstance would be. Like, is it based on how much time you spend or how much time, you know, consecutively you do it? Or is it an accumulation thing?
Yeah.
What kind of games does it affect? But yeah, I mean, if it's going to, if it's going to permanently damage my cognitive functions, I think I could probably give up long FPS sessions.
Yeah, I'm not going to like keep eating a certain kind of food if I like makes me puke every time I eat it.
But if it's the kind of thing that's like this cell phone is probably doing something bad to my brain when I hold it near my head, you know, like there's a lot of unstudied elements of the modern world that are probably
not great
for us.
Yeah.
So it would have to be at a severity at which it's worth actually acting on. I kind of just accept that most everything that surrounds us is bad for us. So it's got to learn to. We're just gonna die early. It's okay.
It's true. It's true. Okay. Moving on. One I want to address real quickly is Sintessa asks, James, are you reviewing Observer? If so, I hope you don't give it a bad review like you did for Layers of Fear. I'm not reviewing Observer. First thing, I'm not reviewing Observer. Secondly, Layers of Fear sucks ass. I think it's one of the worst horror games I've ever played.
Wow.
Observer, I have played a preview of it. And I have access to the same preview that Jody McGregor is reviewing it for us right now.
Correct.
And he's a cyberpunk expert. It's, I think, had a good reception overall and within games media. But so did
some people called Layers of Fear a phenomenal horror.
I can't understand. There's a part where a fucking possessed doll runs down a hallway and hits its head on a dresser in front of you, and that's supposed to be a scare. It's like hee 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 donk, and I laughed. Anyway,
that sounds like it's supposed to be funny.
I can't do this again. I reviewed that thing. I can't go back. But Observer is shaping out to be a much more interesting game, in my opinion. So check out our preview coverage. PCGamer.com/Observer should have some stuff there. We should have the review in the coming days, I'm thinking. So I anticipate better reception. Kanifu. What are your thoughts on esports potentially making an appearance at a future Olympic Games? A required step for the sport to be taken seriously, or should it exist as a separate entity? It's interesting.
I mean, what does taken seriously mean? Like, I think in a lot of ways, esports are now taken seriously. There's so much money in them. Are they considered real sports? Like, you know,
I'm not gonna air do quotes. That. Yeah,
is that what's required?
It's beside the point.
Taken seriously, right? in the mainstream maybe of not. People who don't care about video games, maybe that's what being taken seriously means.
Yeah,
I think being at the Olympics would definitely influence that in some way. It would have an impact there. Being at an event like the Olympics would, I think, give you the potential for a style of commentary that we may not see on in gaming commentary very much these days, about kind of the skill and rigor and like physical application required to play these kind of games competitively. That's the kind of thing that maybe you would see in Olympic commentary. Whereas I think, you know, we write for an audience of people who play video games. We use terminology that we expect people who play video games to understand, that someone who has never played a game in their life would be kind of lost reading, right? And I think esports commentary is kind of similar in that way.
Yeah,
you know, there are like streams for Dota newbies and stuff like that at tournaments, but in general, if you're listening to the main commentary channel, they're going to be naming abilities and using lingo that like is totally foreign to someone who hasn't followed that game. So I think that would be an interesting change for esports, to see how it is depicted for a wider audience and how people kind of come to understand what it takes to play a game like Counter-Strike or Dota competitively. Yeah. And I think a lot of people who, if they were watching the Olympics and saw an esport, they would go, oh, this is actually really hard and complicated, and it's not just, you know, 18-year-olds, you know, just clicking in their bedroom. Like, it's actually quite a sport in its own right.
Yeah, I'd be totally open to that. I think that would be great to see. I think I'd be more curious to see how like regulations pan out in terms of like, okay, you know, regulation Olympic water polo has specific rules specific to Olympic play. Maybe not the best example because I can't name any of those, but you know, there are regular, it needs to be unified for the world,
right?
And games themselves are you know, unified. Competitive games like Dota, it's like anyone playing Dota in the world is going to play the same Dota. But I'm wondering, like, who do the Olympics align themselves with, right? Like, are we just going to do League of Legends and Dota? Like,
which game
is the, you know? So I'd be curious to see how that pans out. But I mean, I'm all for it.
Be prepared for, if this happens, a lot of jokes about the gamers in the Olympic Village, which is notorious for its, like, orgies of incredibly toned athletes at the prime of their physique, and then bring esports into that, and be ready for the jokes about that, because there's going to be a lot.
I'm so ready. Okay, Mutton Bandit asks, this scenario. For some reason, bring one game into a Voyager style space capsule. What game do you want the aliens to play? What game would you show aliens if you were abducted? Basically, what's your favorite game? Or what would you introduce another sentient race of creatures to introduce them to video games?
Maybe Mario.
I think Mario. I think Jazz Jackrabbit. Probably Jazz Jackrabbit.
I feel like that Jazz gets pretty weird. I mean, not that Mario.
I'm kidding.
Isn't
it would
not be.
Mario, I think, like, a single button game, you can understand the figure and the goal fairly easily.
Because I think if you start with, you know, a Doom or something, like, you're really painting a picture of the human race that may be negative.
What about Destroy All Humans? I think that'd be a good one. It's hard to say. I think, like, a Mario or some kind of, you know what? You know what? Sonic Colors. Okay, moving on.
A bad Sonic game.
A bad Sonic game. They'll fucking just blow us off the map.
Maybe they'd love it.
I'll get to Deej Bruce's in a sec, but BattleTank09 asks, is the Twitch Discord style app going to compete well against Discord? So is the Twitch desktop app going to compete well against Discord? It's funny you say that, because we just put up sort of our take on that. And... that's from Lauren Morton. She is a pretty avid Twitch user, streams a lot, is in the Discord a lot, and she thinks the app is basically a very ungainly way to do everything. So it has some features that the Discord app does not at the moment, like screen sharing and video chat, but you can't watch multiple streams at once. You can't. Because you're not in a browser, you can't do some things that people have become accustomed to, especially with, you know, third-party applications like or sites like that allow for multi-streams and like are built around the premise of that. And some of the interface ideas feel a little bit like kind of just latched on there for just to keep it familiar to Twitch, but
not a huge surprise.
Yeah, it's just kind of clunky in that way.
But I think that's absolutely, going back to the question, the goal is for, you know, why would Twitch want you to go to any other platform when they could keep you in their world and integrate that more and more with Amazon stuff, sell you games,
exactly,
keep you chatting in their chat with their, you know, build their own communities, have their own subscriptions and tips and all that stuff. Like, why would they want you to go anywhere else? So I think that's definitely the goal.
It's not a surprise that they have a desktop app. It's just that it's not very good yet. So, I mean, they have a store or your game library in the app. And if you have Amazon Prime, you will have free Twitch Prime. Is that what it's called? Twitch Prime now?
I think so. Yeah.
And you'll get free games and stuff, and those will show up in your library, and that's kind of nice. Like, because I don't even know what the fuck I own on Twitch. Like, I have some games, I guess.
You should check.
So now I have a library for that. But if you want to buy anything, it just kicks you out to the browser. So it's not all there yet. And overall, just the user experience on Discord's end is better. We kind of both agree. There's no real, unless you're like a diehard, your community lives on Twitch and you're a diehard Twitch user and you're already embedded there, there's not really a reason to use it. If you're happy on Discord, if you're happy like just alt tabbing between a window or two, You know, there's no real cell quite yet. And Discord also has some more security features. Just read the feature. It's pretty good.
But I'm sure Twitch will continue to try to push that becoming more and more of a platform, more Definitely. And more of its own dedicated thing.
Yeah. Stay tuned for more from that. But Deej Bruce asks, did you ever decide what the best butt in video gaming was? I don't think you were here last week for that, Wes. Do you have a...
Has this been given deep thought?
I said I would come back with a list of 20 of the best butts, and I came back with a list of 0 of the best butts. Because I can't think of any, I don't know. I think the Warframe characters did some pretty good butts. They're like chiseled from iron and space alloys.
Chiseled is good.
Yeah, yeah. I think Sonic has a pretty good ass.
Solid Snake.
Solid Snake, very good butt. Especially Big Boss in the new Metal Gear Solid 5 is like, I could watch that sprint animation all day.
Let's go with Big Boss. I mean, it's kind of there in the name already, right? Yeah, like Big Buns, Big Boss.
Yeah, yeah. So we're gonna settle on Big Boss. If Geralt has a pretty good butt too, but I think we talked about that already. That's like a known. That's like the sky is blue. Come on,
it's too obvious. Yeah, yeah. Dig deeper.
Right on. Let's take a peek here. Do we have any other subscriber questions? Apollo Dingo, my arch nemesis. Not my arch nemesis. I just want to know why Wes isn't out here talking about twin stick shoot 'em ups. I know he knows why they're the superior genre, and I know he knows the living gaming god Eugene Jarvis is still working on them. Do you know who Eugene Jarvis is?
The name is, that's not the Tempest guy, right? That's a different. Yeah, I know the name, but I cannot place it off the top of my head.
Are you a known connoisseur of twin stick shooters?
I'm
you out?
I'm confused about this. I mean, I like some twin stick shooters. I don't think I have a reputation.
Yeah.
I really liked Smash TV back in the day.
there you go.
Big fan of, I'm blanking on the Xbox 360 launch. Twin
Geometry Wars.
Geometry Wars.
Great stuff.
Love Geometry Wars. That game, Android Assault Cactus, is a more recent one. That's a fun. It's a fun twin stick shooter. But yeah, I'm not sure why this has been thrown at me. This twin stick challenge.
Well, we'll get back to you on twin stick shooters. I know there's one that we reviewed pretty well, and I've been meaning to play it, and the name is escaping me. So if you know what that is, pop it in chat, and I'll shout it out. Mutton Bandit has another pretty good question here. Jaximal, first of all, where's my shout-out for last week's sub? I'm sorry I missed you. I don't know how many weeks or months you're at, but we really appreciate you. Thanks for hanging out with us. My bad.
Okay, Eugene Jarvis actually worked on Smash TV, I guess.
Oh, shit.
So, there you go. Yeah, I like Smash TV. Great game.
Apollo is known for being a...
I've played Robotron.
Bit it's confrontational.
So a little troll. Little before my time, but I played it.
Mutton Bandit, I like this question. Do you think you reviewed any games, quote, wrong, end quote, in retrospect?
I mean, I wrote a lot of game reviews on my fan page as a 14-year-old that probably don't hold up real well in hindsight. I think I gave a Donkey Kong 64 a great review.
Regret that. God damn.
That was probably wrong.
I think there's plenty of games I've like reviewed and looked back and went, I wish I would have said this differently, or I wish I would have addressed this topic or whatever. But it's like it's impossible to be comprehensive in our reviews. And I think, I won't like second guess my score very often. Well, scores are so arbitrary. It's like not quite arbitrary. We have our guidelines, but... My personal experience score does not always measure up to what someone else will give. So there's always going to be, you know, I personally at least like always go, did I score it what someone else would, or am I giving it too much leeway, or am I da ba da, you know? So in that way, I'm always wondering, but usually we just talk to our editors and kind of nail it down.
What about That Dragon Cancer? How do you feel about that one?
Oh my God, man.
We made James review that and he did a great job.
It was a tough one to review. I think I stand by that one. It's like one of the reviews I've given the most thought and agonized over. And I mean, it's a game I wish I didn't have to give a score to, you know? But, you know, that's the unique challenge of sort of the job sometimes. And I think at the very least, I stand by the text and the number may not like mean as much as I think the text reflects, especially because like it's hard to compare like such a personal, like basically a diary, like and review that as like a recommended buy or not. It's like a weird thing to do, but yeah, I stand by that one. I think I love Dark Souls 3 a lot. There's some, like, I don't know if I would still consider it the best Dark Souls, like, calling it the best. In my review, I called it the best Dark Souls to play or something. And I stand by the fact that it's like, I think it's the most fun to play.
Definitely feels the best.
It feels the best. But since then, I've had time to like pore over lore theories and come to understand the world completely. And there are things I'm disappointed in mm-hmm. terms of like how the lore pans out and how certain things like articulate in the game. But I don't think the average person is going to have that experience. They're going to play the game, be like, God damn, this is rad. It feels good to play. And it's worth this, you know, this score makes sense. If you play it and like this, just like study the lore for a year or two, then, you know, some more criticisms might bubble to the surface, but I don't think that stuff necessarily belongs.
That's true of practically any game.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can't think of any off the top of my head that I've reviewed that I feel bad about looking back on, but I haven't really reviewed that many games. It's not my area of focus, so I don't have like a huge library.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see if we got any more questions. Scrolling. We don't have time for too many more, so if you have them, do send them. DJ Bruce says Jazz Jackrabbit 2 is my jam. I think I pirated that game when I was like 10. That's how I learned.
You still can't buy it.
Yeah, that's right. It's a bummer. It's a huge bummer.
Put Jazz Jackrabbit on GOG.
Please, Cliffy. Clifford. We beg you.
I don't think he could. I think it's Epic.
I think it's out of his hands at this point. JBJ Blaze, long time listener, long time subscriber, asks, now that StarCraft has finally been remastered, what's the next Blizzard game you'd like to see remastered? Maybe even another game from another developer? For me, it's all of id's 90s games plus Catacomb 3D. 'Twas late because I work later hours at my family's gun shop after my grandfather's passing. Hey, damn, I'm sorry to hear that, man. I should have read ahead. But sorry to hear that. Thanks for the question. Do you have another Blizzard game you'd like to see remastered?
You know, I don't know that Warcraft 3 needs a remaster, but I think it was a bummer that it wasn't really readily available, easy to play, like through the Blizzard, the Battle.net launcher and stuff like that. And I know they just recently launched like a PTR for it because mm-hmm. they are starting to actively patch that game again. Cool. So maybe that's something that's coming. I don't know the full details there.
That'd be rad.
But I think Warcraft 3 is a game that deserves to be just playable. You know,
yeah,
like you can still play StarCraft very easily, but Warcraft 3 is just still kind of a pain to play, I think. So I would like to see that just kind of fully integrated and given the modern playability treatment, even if they don't touch the graphics or anything.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt, like, StarCraft is definitely a priority for them, but I wouldn't doubt, like, that's in the pipe
long term. I'm getting the feeling it's coming, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Final Fantasy IX is one of my favorite games of all time, and I'm really glad that they put it on PC recently. It's probably been about a year, and I'm not that big on remasters in general. I'd rather see new stuff. Mm-hmm. But one real shame with the version of that game that they put on PC and just all ports of it since its original version is the kind of common like fan wisdom about the development of that game is they no longer have like the original assets used for a lot of the backgrounds. And a lot of the backgrounds in that game are actually like FMV because they have animated elements and stuff moving around. So they're not just a static image. Yeah. And so they didn't have these like higher res source files that they could go to when they ported it to PC. So they just had to up res these like, you know, 640 by 480 like JPEGs, you know, more or less. So there are some scenes that really don't look very good anymore. And it's still a really fun game to play, but it's also a game where the battle system was kind of hampered by the PlayStation 1 at the time. Like it doesn't run at the the speed of your inputs and actions does not correspond to like how they actually play out because the animations take too long and stuff, it would not be hard to refine that battle system and really tweak it and mm-hmm. make it better with a remaster version of that game. And like mm-hmm. the art style could look incredible with a full on like HD hand drawn kind of look. Tight. So that game could look gorgeous and play better if they did a remaster for it, but it's still fun the way it is. So I still love it.
I would just remaster, like I last week I brought this up, that old Beast Wars PC game. Give me that in full HD, high res textures.
Beast Wars.
There's an old Beast Wars PC game. It's probably god awful, but I want it.
You want it?
I want it. I think I got a demo for it in a cereal box, and I miss it.
Was there a reboot game? Did you watch Reboot?
I don't know. Yeah, I know Reboot.
I mean, it's based in, it is a game, right, in the world of Reboot?
There had to be a Reboot game, right?
That's probably a Reboot game.
That seems like a natural tie-in. Okay, so let's, I think we have time for one more question. Favis is yelling at me. He doesn't have a sigil next to his name, so I always skip over his questions. God damn it, this fucking question. Who is the sexiest game dev besides Cliffy B? And I'm scared to answer this for what it, how it will reflect on me or damage my reputation or, but I'd rather not. I'd rather not answer, but I want to say the game dev that I think is the most amiable, or someone I like a lot. You know what I mean? I just kind of like follow them and enjoy seeing, even if I don't care about their game. Mm-hmm. Or like, I think Jeff Kaplan has just like an amazing, weirdly hypnotic, like Mr. Rogers-esque presence when he talks about, you know, patch notes or whatever for 10 minutes in his updates. And I think a lot of people would agree with me in that way. He's become this like dad in you know, game dad for the Overwatch folks.
Good pick.
Yeah.
Do I have to pick one too, or does that count?
That can count. I want to like step away from like calling any game developer sexy, because that's like weird to me. But is there like someone, a game developer that you just kind of like, you follow and enjoy
now,
hearing from?
No, when you say follow, it starts to get in the funky territory.
You follow home at night. No, who you just like sort of, you enjoy hearing what they're doing, or like, or their ideas, or presence in some way online.
Former PC Gamer editor Tom Francis, always really
definitely.
Interesting, insightful, fun guy, just on Twitter, and when he writes on his blog whatever game he's playing or the game he's making, Heat Signature, he'll put up fun GIFs from that. But he also like did great GIF series when he was playing Dishonored 2, and just like
definitely
finding
those
cool,
were so good.
Cool stuff to do with the combat system in that game.
Yeah, if you don't follow Tom Francis anytime like a new immersive sim comes out, or like heavily systemic game, like follow him. Especially like his new game, what's it fucking called?
Heat Signature.
Looks like it's the most Tom Francis thing you could ever imagine. So I'm excited to see it when that comes out.
And if you want more sexy game developers, find the Men of Game Dev calendar. It's like 3 or 4 years now. Some great material. Some great
Evan does chime in and say it's Josh Sawyer easily though. And I have to agree.
Ooh,
he's a very handsome man. He's a very, handsome man. Okay. Well, that's enough of that. That's going to do it for us today on the PC Gamer Show. Thanks for tuning in. If you're listening to us on iTunes or whatever your podcast subscription service is, be sure to leave us a review or give us some feedback. We always want to know how we can improve. And I definitely want to figure out how to get our image working in the RSS feed, because I don't know why it's not. I've been poking at that idea for a little bit. You know, continue to send me angry tweets about that, but I'm working on it.
The more angry you direct James, the better. It fuels him.
I don't know how to do half this stuff. Otherwise, you can catch us every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific time on twitch.tv/PCGamer, or you can go to youtube.com/PCGamer and catch the VOD there. Or you can just, you know, go to PCGamer.com/tag/podcast, and you can look at our whole backlog of posts and listen to them at your leisure. But anyway, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.